from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
Now to our developing story. More schools being threatened by social media clown accounts.
He is a bully.
Shut up.
He started the birther movement.
You did.
He says climate change is a hoax invented by China.
It's pronounced China.
He hasn't released his tax returns, which means he's either not that rich,
wrong,
not that charitable,
wrong,
or he's never paid taxes in his life.
Warmer.
When Donald Trump says women should be punished, or Mexicans are rapists and criminals,
I'm telling
or John
you.
McCain's not a hero, he is showing you who he is.
Senator, you whipped out that Mexican thing again.
It is hard to listen to some of the week's news out of context, including some from the vice presidential debate last night. John Dankosky here in The Wheelhouse with Colin McEnroe, as always. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello, Colin.
You know, statements like "you whipped out that Mexican thing again" show how important context is.
It really does. Hopefully we'll have a little bit of context around this today with Mark Bazniokas. He's Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Hello, Paz.
There will be no whipping out.
And Christine Stewart, editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Hello, Christine.
Good morning, John.
If you would like to join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. The really interesting thing for me about the debate was before the debate even started, the RNC had declared a winner. A tweet went out that said the consensus was clear after the dust settled. Mike Pence was the clear winner of this debate. The post was on GOP.com. Reporters spotted it sometime in the 7 o'clock hour. The debate was about 2 hours away. There were a lot of interesting moments last night. Let's actually listen to one here. It has to do with some of the insults flying back and forth.
So, Senator, this insult-driven campaign, I mean, that's small potatoes compared to Hillary Clinton calling
Senator Kane,
of Donald Trump's supporters a basket of deplorables.
Hillary Clinton said something on the campaign trail, and the very next day she said, you know what, I shouldn't have said that.
She said she shouldn't have said half.
Governor, this is Senator Kane's 2 minutes, please.
That's right. So now we're even.
Yeah.
Okay. Colin, that's what a lot of it sounded like last night. Is that the only thing you heard?
Well, it's certainly not the only thing that we heard. I mean, I think it's first of all important to understand that these debates tend not to be well-remembered or particularly consequential. If you can remember the debate between John Edwards and Dick Cheney, like I'm pretty sure there was one. There must have been one, right?
All I remember is the account that Cheney looked at Edwards and basically said, "Now, who are you? Yeah. I've never seen you around."
So, I mean, that's sort of like I really can't remember that debate at all. I probably actually did see it. So, I mean, something has to go drastically wrong for any of these debates to matter. Now, this was an unusual debate just in the sense that, you know, the top of the ticket candidates are the ones who are not only sucking up all the oxygen in this race, but also they're the ones who are kind of the attack dogs in this race. Frequently you have maybe a Sarah Palin or a Joe Biden or somebody like that second on your ticket who can say some of the more snappish things and be a little bit more edgy while you get to be the good cop at the top. Well, this is just not happening in this debate. These two guys were, at least until last night, supposedly, you know, the scoutmasters. But like they were wrestling next to the campfire last night, so they were. It was like bad Scoutmaster time. I would say in general, the thing that we learned is so often the case. I mean, we didn't learn anything about policy because these things are never about policy. What we learned was that Mike Pence sees himself as having a long political career ahead of him that could be significantly damaged if he over-adhered to the ideas and rhetoric of Donald Trump. So, I mean, I doubt a vice presidential candidate has ever so significantly separated himself from the top of the ticket in a debate. If it's ever happened before, I've never seen it. And I think he did it to his own great credit and advantage too. I mean, I think he came out of the debate – I hate saying who won a debate. He came out of the debate looking a little bit better than Kane. I think Kane's level of aggressiveness, you know, was probably a turnoff to a lot of people.
To his own great credit and advantage, but to the credit and advantage of Donald Trump, do you think, Paz? I mean, did the work that Mike Pence did last night to moderate the message, to not come out swinging quite in the same way Tim Kaine did, to try to deflect the criticism about Donald Trump over and over again, did it actually work at all for Donald Trump?
I watched Toronto and Baltimore from – no. No, I don't believe it either helped or hurt him. The base is certainly going to love what Governor Pence said. evangelicals, people who are moved to vote Republican because of the abortion issue. I think we're delighted with what the governor said. And, you know, he brought partial birth abortion into the debate. That is always an uncomfortable topic for pro-choice people. They would prefer to have that debate on more abstract terms about a woman's right to choose and not get into procedures. But again, in the end, who does it move? You know, the best line of vice presidential debates was Lloyd Bentsen, who practically induced Dan Quayle to burst into tears. And at the end of the day, so what? We all had a moment.
And we didn't have a vice president, Lloyd Bentsen.
And we did not have a vice president, Lloyd Bentsen, right. You know, I would have loved to have been in the room and listening to what Dan Malloy was screaming at his television, because Malloy has indirectly debated Governor Pence, and I will say far more effectively than Senator Kaine did last night on the issues of LGBT as well as the Syrian refugees. Kaine did nothing with the LGBT issue. I mean, Pence was vulnerable for having been found in the case of the LGBT community to have discriminated. I mean, he was denounced by civic and business groups, and more recently on the Syrian refugees. He was totally spanked by the Republican judges on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals.
I will say, Christine, that, you know, maybe those of us in the news media and those of us who have moderated political debates before pay a little bit more attention to moderators than a lot of other people do. I think there are some good things and some bad things about the job that Elaine Quijano did from CBS News last night. But I think not bringing up LGBT issues, not actually forcing either candidate to talk much about their records, both in running state government and working in federal government, that seems to me to be a big weakness of this. The fact that we didn't hear as much about Mike Pence and how he views refugees, Mike Pence and how he views the LGBT community, and really until the very end, how Tim Kaine feels about abortion, I think was a weakness of the debate format.
I think so, too. I think that she was unable at times even to get her questions answered by the two. The two seemed to go back and forth between each other as if she wasn't there. And, you know, and I think that Republicans were a little upset that they felt that she kept cutting off Mike Pence as opposed to, you know, making sure that Tim Kaine stayed in line. So I think that Mike Pence's message was basically we need change. And Tim Kaine's message was Trump is scary. And so I think that, you know, he effectively, you know, brought home the or reiterated the point about Trump's taxes, which Connecticut did not release, apparently.
Well, and actually, let's listen to a little bit of the back and forth, because taxes just came up over and over again.
Donald Trump is a businessman, not a career politician. He actually built a business. Those tax returns that came out publicly this week showed that he faced some pretty tough times 20 years ago. But like virtually every other business, including the New York Times not too long ago, he used what's called net operating loss. We have a tax code, Senator, that actually is designed to encourage entrepreneurship.
But why won't
country.
He release his tax returns?
Well, we're answering the question about the business thing.
Okay. So, Colin, Tim Kaine over and over again kept coming back to Donald Trump's taxes. And, of course, since last week's show, this big revelation about Trump's taxes in the New York Times. I guess I'm wondering how you feel this issue is playing out amongst the candidates, both last night in the debate, but also in the campaign trail, just amongst people, because it is this very interesting, perhaps nuanced conversation about what is right and wrong with the tax code, what we should expect rich people to do to get around the tax code, whether or not that matters to the rest of us who dutifully pay our taxes because we don't have $1 billion to spin off into losses for the next 18 years. I mean, how do you think this whole thing plays out?
I have a lot of thoughts about this, but I want to begin by saying I think it's sort of the whole thing is bad journalism and bad politics, and the bad journalism is kind of occasioned by Donald Trump's refusal to release his tax records. If he would do this, we wouldn't have all this happening. But what you've got is three pages of a 1995 tax return from which is being treated like some kind of Rosetta Stone, which if you sand it down and rub it and trace the letters, you can figure out all this stuff. The reality is, and what's happened is, this has gone from the New York York Times, you know, pretty responsibly saying, well, this is what we have. This is, you could maybe conclude this based, you know, but that sort of rolled over into secondary and tertiary iterations. He didn't pay any taxes for 18 years. Well, we don't know that. We don't really quite understand what the net operating losses cited on that line are or what they represent. There's so many things that we don't know. And for Trump supporters to complain about that is a little bit like Eric and Lyle Menendez asking for mercy because they're orphans. I mean, the problem with this is we just don't have the actual requisite material that we should have to be able to talk about this. So, you know, it certainly has turned into a conversation that's about Trump not paying taxes. I have no idea whether Trump pays his taxes or not. Nobody except people very close to him have any idea about that. But I also think, just very quickly, the other thing that's happening here is, you know, the journalism fraternity feels very assailed. You go on social media and you are just told by people of every political hue and stripe that you suck. And so one of the ways we're told about this all the time is basically this is an asymmetrical election. Trump is really horrible in a way that's unprecedented. We need unprecedented journalistic techniques. We are not marshaling those, you know. But sometimes marshaling those means like putting three of your best people on the Alicia Machado story and trying to figure out whether she made a soft porn film or something, which doesn't really feel good if you're like Maggie Haberman or some like really well-established political journalist. One thing about this story is you can work on it and feel like a real journalist. You know, you can try to figure out all this stuff and feel like you're an actual political journalist, which I think is not so true with some of the stories that Trump being who he is, like, you know, how much weight Rosie O'Donnell gained or something, that doesn't really feel like something, you know, that Glenn Thrush should be working on.
Paz.
You know, journalists, I think, have stepped up their game collectively in the last 4 weeks or so. And, you know, when I was driving home last night on NPR, for example, there was a story that took Trump's statement that he had a fiduciary responsibility to pay as little taxes as possible, which is nonsense. That's not what fiduciary means. I mean, this was his personal taxes. This was not his obligation to shareholders or anybody else. And even if you had shareholders, there are corporations that for a variety of reasons that are allowable are not as aggressive to avoid taxes. I mean, they will do all kinds of things to protect their brand and to build their business. So, you know, people are calling Trump when he makes these absolute statements, which he has done time and time again. But the question is, at this point in the game, is it a bit late?
I mean, could I just build on that? So on Sunday, Rudy Giuliani, as a surrogate, made a whole bunch of appearances on with Chuck Todd and with Jake Tapper, saying this whole thing that Trump could have been sued if he didn't exploit every possible loophole to pay as few taxes as possible. You know, and it really would have been great if one of those guys could you tell me somebody who has been sued by his partners or investors for failing to get all the available deductions on his personal tax returns? Because, I mean, Giuliani and some of the other surrogates talked about that as though everybody knows that, right? You get sued if you don't make your taxes as low as possible. Doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen.
You do, however, get sued for non-payment for services, which is something that has actually come up and been reported on over and over again in Donald Trump's political and business career.
Well, what is so frustrating is that none of this matters to Trump supporters at all. It does not matter whatsoever. They don't care about his taxes. They don't care if they're released. They don't actually even care about factual fact-checking of statements that Donald Trump has made. They don't care. They see him as a change agent, and that's who they're voting for, no matter what you present them with and no matter what facts you present, which is frustrating for journalists.
Well, I mean, speaking of journalism, I mean, the Washington Post this week, Paz, did the story about this sort of alternate reality around a Trump supporter, went to Western Pennsylvania, my home stomping grounds, and found a character who I think it's fair to say a lot of us might not have given that much attention to after spending that much time with her. I mean, we've all done interviews with people saying, well, wow, she or he is saying some pretty remarkable things. And then we think, is that someone who we believe is sound enough of mind to build a feature story around? And many of us have spiked stories like that. And I look at the Washington Post story, which many people have read, and we'll tweet out. I don't know what your feeling is, Paz. I shook my head and kind of sobbed a little bit inside at that one.
I had that very argument in my head when I was reading the piece. But at the end, I thought, first off, it was a riveting piece of reporting and writing. I mean, it was fascinating to get into this woman's head. And then the question is, I mean, if anybody hadn't read it, it's a woman who has basically embraced every conspiracy theory that's out there, and a few that I didn't know were out there. Michelle Obama, transgender, who knew?
If you read the right things, people say that. People are saying that, Pat.
Although the evidence that this woman cited for that was a joke that Joan Rivers made. So, but
they had her killed for it, too.
Yes, you know. But at the end, I thought, okay, this reflects something that's out there. The story did not overreach, I didn't think. It didn't say this represents a vast swath of America. But it did say there's this element out there of this alternate reality. And we see it in social media. You know, we see it with the birther movement. We see it with the deniers of Sandy Hook. And some of us, you know, we avert our eye. I mean, I try not to go too deep on the Sandy Hook stuff because I've met too many of those parents, and I find myself getting too angry. And of course, implicit in that is I am also part of the conspiracy because it's this great conspiracy of silence. And it's easy to say it's nonsense. So I give the Post credit for taking a hard look at this stuff.
The only thing I'll say is, I mean, to use Colin's earlier phrase, it's almost as though it's being used as a type of Rosetta Stone from which you can divine all of these things about all of these, you know, quote unquote, crazy Trump supporters out there. And I think that's the problem with a story like this, is it encapsulates in one person so many of the issues and problems that we're facing right now that I felt like it was a little too tied up in a bow.
No question. I keep saying the trick to these things is you can't overreach. You know, it's when we all write slice of life stories, the key is, again, not to make more of it than it is, you know.
Well, two quick things about this. So George Saunders had a great line in one of his pieces for The New Yorker about sort of this issue of perception based on where your information comes from. He said, imagine that you and I are riding up towards a castle and all of your information about castles, all of it, comes from Game of Thrones. And all of my information about castles comes from Monty Python and the Holy Grail. What are the chances that we're going to see the castle the same way, or even be able to have a conversation about the castle? And sort of that's a little bit of the mess that we're in right now, is that people are getting their information from these very, you know, exclusive boutique sources. The other thing I would quickly say is I'm more interested, I think it was David Greene as I was coming in today. You know, he's got this pool of voters who watched last night's debate. And there were a couple of people there who said something I thought that was very interesting. One woman is struggling. You know, she's like a devout Catholic, I think, and she's not really enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton, and she knows that Donald Trump is a personally immoral man. But she's looking at Mike Pence, and it was almost as though she was saying, Mike Pence is giving me permission to vote for this ticket. You know, like I really, because of my religious beliefs, I'm going to cast a vote based on my religious and moral convictions about issues like abortion. And I can see somebody who might. She said, I think the fact that Donald Trump chose Mike Pence makes me feel better about Donald Trump. That's the kind of persuadable voter that I'm a little bit more interested in than Miss Cuckoo Bird, who's like, you know. Anyway.
Well, let me quickly go to Andrew in West Hartford before we break. Hi, Andrew. Go ahead. You're on the Wheelhouse.
Oh, hi. I've listened to your show for years and always enjoyed it. One thing that struck me this morning, though, is the lack of balance in the presenters. And the other comment is just, it appears that the newscasters are inserting themselves as if they're a player or have a role in this. And I think it's time for the newscasters to take themselves out of it and just report the news.
So, and I appreciate the thought very much. When you say just report the news, give me a better sense, Andrew, of what exactly you mean. What news needs to be covered that's not being covered?
Well, I just think there's a lot of opinion expressed as though it's part of the reporting on the news. And I am, you know, candidly an undecided voter. And I just find it offensive that it's very difficult as an undecided voter to get the news without opinion inserted into or commentary inserted into it. And I think this program this morning is a perfect example. I'm not sure there's any balance in what's being presented.
Well, because I have you on the line and you're an undecided voter, did anything you heard last night change your mind about who you might vote for?
No, I'm candidly probably like a lot of undecided voters, very much struggling. There's not any good option among the two main party candidates. So I would say, you know, Kane was particularly, you know, annoying, I found, just in his interruption, just as a personal matter. I think it interesting that gender has been such an important part in this campaign, and no one's really focused on how the two gentlemen interrupted the female newscaster.
I think that, and I think you make a very good point. Andrew, thank you so much for your phone call. I'm wondering, Christine, if you have a sense of the undecided voter when you talk to people around Connecticut for any of the stories that you're covering. I mean, how many Andrews do you think are out there right now in our world?
I haven't been able to find a lot of them. So as Andrew was speaking, I was like, ooh, I wonder what his phone number is so I can call
it's
him.
It's right up here on the screen right now. Save that phone number. Well, you know, and that's the question, Colin. I mean, we bring this up all the time. What exactly does an undecided voter mean right now? All of the networks had panels of undecided voters who they were talking to last night. As you said, NPR did again this morning. Many of them were undecided for different reasons. You profiled one that you just heard from. I mean, I don't know how many Andrews are out there and how much difference they make.
I think what we have in this election to an unusual degree is a preponderance of what I call less decided voters. So, I mean, you have some genuinely undecided voters. Andrew sounds like he might be really one of them. You also have a lot of people who are essentially voting against a candidate as opposed to for a candidate. That kind of support is frequently softer. In other words, basically it's a negative choice. Maybe you don't like either one of your options. So it's maybe a little bit easier to toggle you back and forth between two possible positions. You've also got a whole bunch of people who are at least dancing with the idea of third-party candidates. Historically and statistically, what happens is a certain amount of that support evaporates on election day. People go into the polling booth and they ultimately decide that they're going to cast a vote that maybe seems more consequential to them. So you wrap all those three things, the genuinely undecideds and then these two groups of kind of less decided voters, and maybe you get something. You get like 18% or something if you start looking. So that's in terms of fungible or persuadable voters, that's an unusually large block. But they're not all the same animal. They're at least three different animals.
Colin McEnroe hosts The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Christine Stewart is editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Mark Pazniokas is Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. When we come back, we're going to rapid fire through a lot of state news, including a brand new plan. Get this ready. We're going to tunnel under the Connecticut River and build a brand new highway for only $10 billion. Sounds great, huh? That's next in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're joined today by Mark Pazniokas. He's the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Christine Stewart, who's the editor at CTNewsJunkie.com. And our own Colin McEnroe, who hosts The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR each weekday at 1 o'clock. Hey, Colin, what's in your show today?
Well, we're giving you a break from the campaign. We're actually rerunning a show that we did. It's the 150th anniversary of the Peabody. We did a wonderful show, we thought anyway, about dinosaurs there last May. We're going to put that up because tonight I'm going to be at Watkinson with Wheelhouse veteran Danny Haar. Ross Garber, one of our favorite good guy Republicans here in the state, and Vivian Martin, chairman of the journalism department at CCSU, for a forum called Honey, I Broke the Democracy, about sort of just where we are in this election and what it's going to take to repair the American civic notion. So anyway, that'll be at 7 o'clock tonight, preceded by a dinner at 6. I think you can still get tickets. Watkinson.org. It's the freshly squeezed series.
Excellent. Very, very good. So that's happening tonight with Colin McEnroe. There's a new proposal by Congressman John Larson to fix Hartford's transportation problems for two tunnels to replace the aging viaduct. $10 billion plan, that's $10 billion, would open the city back up to the Connecticut River, now cut off by the existing highways. The state's already been involved in a very long planning process to figure out the best solution to the city's problems having to do with the viaduct in I-84 and at 91. Should we take this proposal at all seriously, Mark?
No.
Moving on. I mean, look, we've been talking about this viaduct plan for years and years and years. John Larson kind of coming in at the not just the tail end of it. We've essentially finalized what's going to happen. There's going to be an at grade or below grade highway. There's not going to be a tunnel. that goes through the middle of Hartford. They're going to try to do some decking over it so that they reconnect some parts of the city. He's talking about something that's much, much, much bigger.
He seems unaware that the DOT studied this at some length, not something on the scale that he's talking about, but to use a tunnel to replace the viaduct. And there's a bunch of very good reasons, both financial and engineering reasons, why they're not going to do that. There is a river under a portion of the viaduct, so that would be a problem. And the expense is just enormous. I mean, they were estimating just a limited portion would be, $7-8 billion, maybe would even bump up to 10. The DOT doesn't get enough credit and for recognizing the damage that highway planners, highway builders inflicted on U.S. cities. And the plan they've come up with would undo a lot of the damage and do it in a way that takes advantage of topography, and it would be like cut and cover as opposed to a true tunnel. I mean, Congressman Larson is talking about a tunnel that would be beneath the Connecticut River and would pop up many miles away, well into East Hartford. The reaction at the DOT, I'm told by folks there, was, you know, a lot of eye rolling. The Malloy administration's reaction is, if anytime you want to show up on our doorstep with $10 billion, we'll listen.
Well,
to the DOT's credit, they did hold public hearings and these design meetings where they would go over with you, you know,
absolutely,
what their various proposals were for this viaduct and you know what they planned to do or where they were leaning. And, you know, they were out there having public hearings a lot, I would say, at least once a month for,
very comprehensive
for a few
process.
Years. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I just heard, Colin, in that last few seconds, two different times people said, to the DOT's credit. That's not something
I
hear.
The same thing. Very few sentences start, the DOT doesn't get enough credit. Let me just say this. Shame on everybody who's not really talking about how transportation is likely to work over the next 10 or 15 years. So all of these proposals are predicated on the notion that the internal combustion engine is going to continue to have its reign over us. I think, you know, even given the incredible lack of leadership, of which this is a symptom, on this subject, sooner or later, we are going to have a day of reckoning. The oceans are rising. The polar caps are melting. We're in a lot of trouble right now. So the notion that we need to spend $10 billion, and it's not really $10 billion, as everyone's suggesting, it's going to cost much more. If we're going to spend money like that, we're going to have to spend money that acknowledges that transportation is going to change. It has to change, and we should spend money that forces it to change. So, I mean, just to have cars race back and forth and get stuck underneath a river in a tunnel, you know, I just it seems like the opposite of having any kind of real vision of the mess we're in and the future that we'd probably have anyway of self-driving cars. And I mean, you know, what are we even talking about here? Running the same play.
And at the same time, rail and bus fares are increasing in December. So, you know, we have an increase on public transportation, which is not being as heavily subsidized because we have this budget issue in the state.
I will point out that the last time Congress was willing to raise the gasoline tax, my youngest child was about 6 months old, and she's now a first-year med student.
Well, look, we're going to just skip ahead quickly because Christine just talked about budget problems. State Comptroller Kevin Lembo raised concerns for the second consecutive month about the stability of the current state budget, although he stopped short of reporting a deficit. Where are we right now with budget concerns at the state level, Christine?
Well, apparently the 2017 budget, according to the comptrollers, essentially in balance, I think was the quote, essentially in balance. But
give or take, you know.
So we're doing better than we were last year. I mean, you know, 2 months into the budget last year, we were definitely beginning to show greater signs of revenue slowing and that there was going to be a deficit after the election. I have no doubt that there's going to be a deficit after the November election. The question is, how big is it going to be?
And there's no truth to the rumor that Governor Malloy sent a bottle of champagne across the street to George Jepson's house after Jepson announced the $120 million settlement. That's where they are, that when you get a settlement like that, it's significant to the budget.
But they did account for that.
They did account.
Not,
I mean,
they
not
said,
that
you
much,
know,
but yes.
I thought it was like $40 million.
$40 million. Right. And they actually put it in the budget instead of using it as a windfall. And this one is – is going to be worth more than that. But that's where they are. That's how tight things are.
Hey, if only we can catch a few more of these banks and doing some dirty dealing, we can really actually balance the state budget. I like this idea. This is a good way to balance the budget, guys. I don't know, Colin.
The taxpayer tip line.
I thought one of Mike Pence's stronger moments last night was when he was describing the fiscal state of Indiana. I don't know how accurate that description was. I haven't checked the fact-checking services yet. But, I mean, look, we're going to have an election in 2018, and presumably somebody is – well, maybe not. But somebody should be proposing a different paradigm for managing the state budget. I mean, what we have right now is a revenue structure that's inadequate to meet needs, a service delivery plan that just involves cutting state employees and cutting the delivery of services to the point where we're really getting into crises of a type that we'll probably be talking about later today. You know, and then this kind of corporate welfare economic development program that really, you know, sometimes you have to do it, but we seem to do it an awful lot, tends to eviscerate whatever disposable income there might have been in the budget. And I think it's fair to say this doesn't work. I would hope that people running for governor in 2018 will look at states where they, in fact, have moved out of this picture and developed a more solid way of funding state services and run on that.
Christine?
So in 2016, the state budget, the general fund spending, was $17.9 billion, and almost 80% of the spending increase, we increased the budget about 2.9%, went toward funding debt service and the state employees' retirement system. So, I mean, debt is at least or even if more, 25% of the total state budget, and it's increasing. So it's crowding out. It's crowding out those operating funds and our ability to serve our residents.
Which is why when Capitol reporters pass dutifully show up at the Bond Commission hearings these days and we hear another long list of things that are going to get funded, we can all go, really, really, we're going to pay money for that? Because I think that much debt service is something that is clearly unsustainable. We just can't add any more to it.
And the awful challenge for these folks is – there's 30 years of mistakes, primarily when it comes to how they funded, or more to the point, did not fund pensions. And now that is unavoidable. And, to Christine's point, yes, that's the trend line. Unfunded liabilities and debt, the trend line is up. Right now, the state is supposed to make good on the pensions by 2032. And if you put that on a chart, it looks like Mount Everest, and then there's a cliff. And that's not going to happen. They're going to have to flatten that out. But that means borrowing money. I mean, there's no magic solution because these are people who are already retired. You can tighten pension benefits that are offered to new employees. You can negotiate that. You can get as tough as you want. But a big part of Connecticut's problem is the money that's been promised to people who are no longer in the employ of the state.
Speaking of a problem that's decades in the making, a new scathing review by the Child Advocate of the near starvation of a baby placed with relatives in Groton reveals, quote, staggering failures and omissions on the part of the Department of Children and Families and raises doubts about DCF's decisions on child placements. Here's State Child Advocate Sarah Egan commenting on the case. This is from the Hartford Current.
You know, the bottom line is here if folks, what happened to this child is not possible in a well-monitored and well-supported placement. In other words, if people were doing their job, this would not have happened.
New calls now, Colin, for the resignation of Joette Katz, who heads up the DCF.
I find it hard not to join those calls. If you read Josh Kovner's chilling piece in today's Hartford Current, I mean, it's really astonishing. And I had started at the Hartford Current in 1976 when there was a DCYF. That's what it was called. It was different, same agency, different name, DCYS. There was a DCYS crisis, not unlike this one. I mean, and they just cycle over and over again. This one is particularly appalling, partly because of electronic communications. You can see the kind of reckless indifference and almost giggling that seems to be going on among state caseworkers who should be treating this as an incredible emergency. I won't go on and on about this. I will say that Kovner's piece ends on this unbelievably chilling note. This baby, who's had broken bones and burns and malnutrition and environmentally triggered developmental issues, is now being sent to appointments that he has alone in a taxi cab. a two-year-old child is being placed alone in a taxi cab unsupervised to go places after they already know they dropped the ball on this kid in every possible way. And, you know, yeah, like everybody who takes over this job fails at it. I get that. But I really feel as though Len Fasano is right. I think Katz has to go. I think we need to know exactly what kind of discipline these workers are getting. I don't think it's an internal matter anymore. I want to know what they call discipline. You know, if it were up to me, these people would face charges.
Well, and I think, Christine, part of the context for this is the conversation we just had about the state budget. I mean, DCF and other large state agencies cost the state an awful lot of money. That is a state agency that, for as long as I've been covering news and politics in Connecticut, has been under investigation or under federal oversight. It continually displays the same problems over and over again, and we are paying for service that gets to the results just of the type that Colin just talked about.
Yeah, so we're going to continue to be under federal oversight, but some of the standards that they're looking at, you know, I guess some have been met so that they are pre-certified. I guess it's complicated, but so they have made progress in renegotiating the settlement in 2011 and then meeting some of these standards. But at the same time, you come up with cases. You know, like this baby in Groton, and you know, that one case is also emblematic of all these other cases, because the Department of Children and Families is now, they're granting waivers to foster families who are relatives but may have a criminal history or drug convictions in their past. And so the child advocate is actually investigating some of these waivers, and some of them, you know, granted, they were okay, and the placement should have been made, and the child should have been kept with the family. But some of them, you know, these are children who are under 4 years old and being placed into households where they shouldn't, despite the nature of the relationship.
The week Joette Katz was appointed, there's a lawyer who's been a not the child advocate, but has been a child advocate for many, many years, said something that was absolutely chilling to me, and said the test for the governor will be what he will do when a child dies and a child will die in DCF care. And her point was, too many governors had flinched at that moment. And in the, you know, during the Rell administration, when there was an effort to remove fewer children, there was a baby who died. And they completely went the other way and made Connecticut one of the states that was pulling more children away from families than I think any other state. So Malloy is committed to this idea of using kinship care. And Joette Katz said the other day that they've pretty much maxed out where they are. So the question is, to what extent do you remove her? Is she the problem? Or to what extent is it you got to keep rooting out people who are not doing the job? I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that Governor Malloy has signaled very strongly his backing of Joette Katz the day before they would have got the draft of the report that came out yesterday. He had an event with Joette Katz to celebrate this very program. And at the time, he knew of this incident. And in fact, I asked him about this incident. Others asked him about this incident. And they made a great point of saying how Joette Katz is, you know, her tenure has been longer than any other DCF commissioner in the country probably at this point, because they get fired a lot.
They do get fired a lot. But, you know, what we have here, I mean, I think everything that both Paz and Christine have said is absolutely true. Although here what we have evidence of what part of the problem was. You know, the question Paz asked, is the policy wrong or are the people executing the policy wrong? Or both. I mean, both is a very strong possibility too. But we do have evidence here that they dropped the ball. All right, the people who are supposed to be doing their jobs, maybe they're stressed, maybe they're overloaded. I'm sure they have bigger caseloads than they should. But this notion that, well, I'm lazy, that's why I'm not opening up the file. There's another point where one of the caseworkers says, I couldn't understand some of the things that this the woman who's actually caring for the child with whom the child was placed could only understand two words she said, and I think the answer back is like LMAO or something.
No, OMG.
OMG.
I laughed out loud. Yeah,
I laughed out loud. I mean, you know, this is not funny stuff. And I know there's some gallows humor when you're on the firing line of a really bad situation. But when you look at the outcome here, I mean, there's just no excuse, no excuse at all. And really, these people have to be held up to public scrutiny even more than they have been. And I think Katz really does have to take the fall for this. I mean, I don't care whether Dan Malloy thinks she's doing a great job. And I also think federal oversight is going to have to be extended further. I mean, they were thinking maybe they'd get out from under the umbrella. I don't see how they do that.
I mean, when Malloy talked about that milestone of the difference in federal oversight, really all they did was say, okay, these are the 12 things you're doing well. Let's focus on the stuff you've got left. And oh, by the way, part of that deal is they can't cut DCF funding anymore.
Well, and Colin makes a good point about discipline. You know, what happened to the three employees who were disciplined? What was that internal discipline? You know, maybe Katz is doing her job by disciplining these people, but obviously there needs to be more training of the staff.
We're talking with Christine Stewart, editor of CTNewsJunkie.com, Mark Pasniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, the Capitol Bureau Chief there, and our own Colin McEnroe. When we come back, a lot more to cover, including Gannett buying Tronc. Tronc smash. We're going to hear more coming up in the Wheelhouse right after this. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking with Mark Pasniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror, Christine Stewart, editor of CTNewsJunkie.com, and our own Colin McEnroe, who's got an event coming up tonight at Watkinson School. We'll tell you a little bit more about in just a moment. We hear this week the two insurance companies, Anthem and ConnectiCare, have both eliminated broker commissions from their proposed rate increases for the health exchange. Christine, why do we care about this? Why do we care about broker commission fees?
Because brokers under Connecticut law are the only independent person who's able to give you advice about what your plan is and, you know, what the best plan is for you. And if anybody's actually read the benefits in their plan, your eyes would gloss over. And there is an opportunity here for people to make some really bad decisions and end up having to pay a lot of money.
Is part of the problem that brokers weren't supposed to necessarily have to be part of this new easy-to-use exchange, but it's actually the way it's turned out?
No, I think brokers were always kind of thought of as part of this, but there was a trend of insurance companies nationally just cutting out the broker fees. And, you know, the state of Connecticut and the exchange could have said, hey, we're going to make you pay these broker fees. This has to be part of the deal. We have to have brokers be a part of this, but they didn't do that.
Yale Medicine and Anthem, meanwhile, face a deadline of October 7th to reach an agreement to keep their doctors within the insurer's network. Yale Medicine represents about 1,400 clinical faculty from the Yale School of Medicine. Here's Senate President Pro Tem Martin Looney, who thinks lawmakers should intervene to prevent potential disruptions for patients.
I am prepared to offer legislation to mandate binding arbitration in these cases rather than leave the public in jeopardy of having a loss of coverage if there's an impasse between an insurer and the provider group.
So here's a dispute, Paz, that actually could affect an awful lot of people in their health insurance and their health care.
Yeah, and we've seen this before, this game of chicken that goes on about the time to renew. It's unnerving if you're in one of these plans. But we saw it in Hartford in 2014. There were some hospitals that suddenly became out of network for a few days. I think for Children's Medical Center, they were out of that network for a couple months before they finally reached term. So it's maddening if that's where your coverage is.
I want to move on quickly to a story that we've been following for quite some time. It seems, though, this week maybe, Gannett, the owner of USA Today, is in talks to buy Tronc. That's T-R-O-N-C. They're the parent company of the Hartford Courant and several other newspapers. What do you think this means, Colin? Are we actually going to see this sale that's been rumored for some time?
I have no idea. I mean, I'm way out of my depth talking about whether giant corporations are going to buy one another. I mean, the one thing that I could sort of say that I do know anything about is that, you know, I mean, newspapers and newspaper brands, obviously they've taken huge hits. They've contracted their workforces. It's still actually kind of a viable way to operate if you do it the right way. I think it may not be viable in the way that big companies really like things to be viable. I do feel as though probably, you know, E.F. Schumacher, small is better, is a good idea for newspapers, going back to local ownership or ESOP plans or things like that. Tronc has not been a good steward, I would say, of the Hartford Courant. You know, who knows whether a new owner would be any better.
Well, I mean, in the news business, we used to keep saying, well, it can't get any worse. And, of course, we were consistently proven wrong. And, you know, people want to complain about a diminished Hartford Current, and there's no question that you know the news staff at one point I think approached 400, and there's somewhere around 100 now, but it can get worse. A news staff of 100 is still a substantial news staff. If you look at the Providence Journal, they're down to 37. And if you look at what Gannett did when they took over the Bergen Record, they quickly slashed things, I think, in half. So, you know, it looks like this is inevitable. I mean, Gannett is offering a hell of a premium on Tronc's price. And but the question, you know, for your listeners and for the readers of the Hartford Current is to what extent will the paper maintain what remains a significant and competent news staff?
I think that if Gannett acquires Tronc, that the news staff at the Current shrinks. I mean, there's no other way for a news organization to be able to find, you know, savings that they're going to want to find in order to appease shareholders. And it's just what happens in these acquisitions.
And I don't want this to sound like too much of a plug for the two organizations that the two of you work for, Christine and Mark. But, you know, I will say that once you get down to the size of 35 people, the size of the Providence newspaper, many other newspapers that have been cut all the way back. One of my two hometown newspapers just went to an all digital, the Tribune Review in Pittsburgh. I mean, look, 35 people, Christine, isn't so much bigger than the CT News Junkie or the Connecticut Mirror that there's a big difference. Only newspapers are so much more expensive to run than something like what you run.
Yeah. I mean, we don't have the print overhead. I mean, we don't have the cost of, you know, printing a newspaper every day and then circulating it, you know. So we've cut that out.
But we are niche organizations. It's a damn important niche. I mean, we're holding office holders accountable, and it's covering important public policy, and we're filling some gaps that have been left by the shrinking news business. But, you know, people still rely on the Hartford Current for a lot of news in Connecticut, and we play off of that. I mean, our public policy coverage, sometimes it's what is happening that they find out in the hinterlands or wherever.
Well, and what you can't do online is you can't open a newspaper and, you know, expect to read a news story and then, you know, go to the sports section or go to the comic section, right, and, you know, stumble across something that you wouldn't, you know, necessarily be going there for.
I mean, one thing that we know is, I mean, everything they're saying is absolutely true, that big companies for the most part don't buy newspapers so that they can expand them. I mean, the exceptions have been maybe the sort of Jeff Bezos model where you have somebody who really has made an awful lot of money doing something else and is now doing this as a status project. He's not the only person to do it. Of course, then you get your Sheldon Adelsons out of that same pool. So that gets a little bit scary. You know, and like locally, we have the New London Day, which has a very different ownership model as well. I like newspapers for all the reasons they're suggesting. They actually are the opposite of the silo effect. Ideally, you wind up reading them and almost kind of randomly knowing a lot more things than when you're done.
And if there's a rich guy out there who needs net operating losses, and you want to offset profits elsewhere.
Hearing so much about net operating losses.
Consider news.
For me before the laws change quickly. If there aren't newspapers calling, who's going to cover all the stories about clowns that are in the news this week? I haven't been following this until, frankly, yesterday. And then all of a sudden, I know this is something you were watching from when it was down in North Carolina. What's happening with clowns?
Well, this is an example of how broken our consciousness is. That, you know, we have people out at UConn taking up arms against the clown invasion. I don't know. If you want to read something that's actually sensible about this, there's a piece up on Slate.com right now about how these clown things actually move in cycles. You know, you get one or two of them, and then you get a couple of idiots who think, well, let's scare the heck out of, you know, our neighbors or something. Let's dress up as clowns and stand at the edge of the woods. And this is – it's an example of just how fried our circuits are. We are damaged units right now to the extent that we are participating, all of us, in this kind of somewhat amusing insanity.
According to the UConn Daily Campus, there were hundreds, if not a thousand or more people who had turned out near a cemetery on the northern edge of campus because they wanted to defend the campus against reports of creepy clowns. And the headline of the Daily Campus, was allegations of clown sightings unconfirmed by UConn police.
Archaeologists sifting through the rubble of our civilization will say, this is when they started doing the clown thing. That was the beginning.
All right. We're almost out of time, and so I want to quickly just ask Colin once again to let us know about how you're going to fix the democracy tonight, Colin.
Yeah, we got the best minds available. Dan Haar, obviously one of the best minds available. Vivian Martin and Ross Garble will be joining me tonight at Watkinson School, and you can join us too. Watkinson.org. Check out Freshly Squeezed.
It's Colin McEnroe. He's the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thank you so much, Colin.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you also to Mark Pazniok, because he's the Capital Bureau Chief for the ever-expanding Connecticut Mirror. Thank you so much, Paz.
Thank you for having me.
And Christine Stewart, the editor of the gargantuan behemoth news organization, ctnewsjunkie.com. Thank you so much, Christine.
Thanks, John.
Thanks to the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network. Our program is produced by Katie Talarski, our executive producer. Heather Brandon is our digital editor. The technical producer is Kyle Wolf. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks so much for joining us.